Welcome to February's Cloud Insight, sponsored by Leidos. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency is all about geospatial data. It's got a lot of analysts. They need analytic tools. Sierra Selman is a data scientist at the NGA, and she advocates to agency leadership and program offices for those analysts. She's also a finalist in this year's Women in Technology Leadership Awards, and she joins me now in studio. Ms. Selman, good to have you in.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about your work. First of all, you are an analyst by background, and what do they do at the NGA? What does an analyst do?
That's correct. We have a variety of different analytic roles. We're most known for analysts that exploit imagery that's collected by our satellite assets. And with that, they're looking all over the world, figuring out what's going on, what activity is occurring, how can we best support our military and decision makers. With that, we use a variety of databases, tools, and visualization capabilities.
I was going to say the NGA gets its data not only from its own birds or federal birds, but you buy a lot of the stuff that's easy to get and cheaper that way. And so you've got many data sources to integrate, correct?
Oh, we do. There's tons. And that's the whole thing, is this the tsunami of data. And we have commercial assets, a lot of the small sats that are going up. We're leveraging those to have more real-time analytics.
So you think of the old days where a black and white picture of something taken from a bottom of an airplane camera, and they would blow it up 10,000 times and say, that looks like a roof. No, it's a septic tank. But now analysts are, as you say, almost overwhelmed with data. So what are the types of tools that they need now to be able to assimilate all of this?
Absolutely. It's funny that you bring that up, because we always use that as kind of an anecdote of just back in the day, you would get one image, you would contemplate it for hours. Now it's that you're in there and in a minute you could have 100 images come in. A lot of the tools that we're trying to develop are sifting through a lot of that imagery, figure out which ones are not useful, which ones are more pertinent to your question. That way we kind of tee them up for the analyst, and then also helping with automated extraction of information, and then kind of real-time algorithms and machine learning to help analysts with normalcy and significant activity.
So is that a fancy way of saying that sometimes there's too much data associated with something you're looking at, and you want to really get to the essentials of what it might be without reverting back to that black and white picture from Plus X film?
Oh, absolutely. And we have all these great phenomenologies, so it's not just black and white. And you can actually have time series. You can dive in, figure out what's going on, look at a different angle. And it's just a very exciting time to be in this field.
And now these tools that you try to get on behalf of the analysts, are they mostly commercial tools, or these are things that you farm out for development? How does the whole supply chain work for analytical tools in the geospatial area?
It is very diverse, but we are very lucky because we're an agency that actually can capitalize on a lot of commercial activity. There are a ton of commercial tools that are out there. We have several partners that provide capabilities. We also have in-house capabilities because we are on a classified domain, and we actually have analysts that develop their own tools. And one of the roles that I had before was mission owner for the analytic services contract. And with that, it was all about bringing in new capabilities, either existing or developing new, to do advanced analytics.
And I had a question, just personal curiosity. You see the use of drones in the commercial space much more frequently now. And people look at infrastructure, the tops of towers, the tops of bridges where you don't want to send somebody, but you can send a little drone.
Yes.
And now NGA, of course, is looking at satellite data and the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any, I guess, convergence of some of this close-up data taken that might be taken for industrial purposes? Can that be blended in, or is there any effort to do that? Does it have use to the NGA?
Oh, it definitely does. We partner with our military units to actually bring in a lot of that footage, and we have teams that specialize just in those assets. But with that, the fusion is really key. So it's interesting to have kind of the track of these drones at the same time that you have satellite imagery to have more of that robust picture about what's going on and get more context.
Yeah, so the drone population, as it grows worldwide, really becomes your kind of zoom lenses for what's up in space.
That's a really fun way of looking at it, yeah.
Cool. Makes me want to become an analyst. We're speaking with Sierra Selman. She's a data scientist at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And tell us about your background. How does one become a data scientist?
Oh, it's been a journey. I actually got a bachelor's in geology, a master's in geographic information systems. And then I started with NGA about 8 years ago. And in that time, it was just that I was a data nerd. I absolutely loved working with, exploiting, and visualizing information. And with that, I just kept pursuing new ways, coming up with new methodologies. And then I started to delve into more of the technology side with databases and services. And it's great to work at NGA because there's a lot of opportunity to actually create your own career. And they've actually sent me to earn my next master's for predictive analytics at DePaul University.
Yeah, so a lot of these mathematical fields and, I guess, ability to analyze visual things is really coming together.
It is. And that's really the power of GeoInt, is that you have a picture which is worth 1,000 words, and you can actually manipulate it, dive in, and see and have better context of a situation in the region.
Now, a lot of the imagery is taken above the clouds, but cloud computing has become a big deal for a lot of data. What is the cloud picture for storage and analytics and so forth at NGA?
It's very exciting. I think you've probably heard about iSight, and that's a larger IC initiative to have a cloud environment for all the different agencies. I would say that NGA is leading the way on actually executing and implementing capabilities into that cloud. But additionally, there's also the new Zipper Cloud, and then also we're leveraging kind of the GovCloud on Amazon on the low side. So it's a very interesting environment where we're moving from these siloed systems to more service-based architecture.
So it doesn't have to necessarily be a government-owned cloud anymore.
Right. We're taking the expertise that Amazon has with their cloud environment and leveraging it for government capabilities. And I think not only is it going to have more staying power because now you have this common environment for all the agencies to play, but it might be a time saver.
Sure. So you could go commercial in this area, but in this particular branch of government, but it would have to be segregated and you would have to have more control over it than, say, if it was just some
yes.
financial application where you might be in a physical cloud with other people that you may not want to be with otherwise.
No, absolutely. And then one initiative that I was leading was within the analytics services contract. We were actually coming up with automated means to move from one cloud to the other with automated security protocols instilled so that you could actually have development on the low side, which is cheaper and faster, and then quickly execute it on these higher domains.
Now, when you get data from suppliers, as the NGA does, they are typically cloud users themselves, but they might be a commercial cloud user.
Yes.
Is there some process for making sure that what comes into the NGA is free of whatever malware might be in their commercial cloud?
Absolutely. It's very rigorous. We have a huge security team that goes through and analyzes different software, different data to make sure that it isn't corrupted or manipulated. But like I was saying, we're trying to actually automate those steps because right now it can be lengthy, but by automating, we can actually take it from weeks and months to days.
And so when NGA then does its own data gathering from its own assets that take pictures and so on and do the overflies, those go into the iSight or to the Zipper Cloud
mm-hmm.
directly?
They do. And then it's just available to the analysts more easily. And everyone is developing different tools to access those pools of data to then do their own sense making.
Now, when you develop tools in-house, as you mentioned, some of them are commercial tools, but some of them are in-house developed tools for analytics. Is there a cloud environment where all that development work is done and stored?
We're getting there. I would say that it's a work in progress, and we are making a lot of strides in building that analytic platform so that we can host data, generate algorithms, and run them in a big data distributed process.
And when you discover a way that might be something shareable with industry or with academia,
mm-hmm.
is there access or do you feel that you can use places like GitHub and other store and share types of platforms for the industry that is also doing similar types of work, industry and academia?
No, absolutely. We have several capabilities that we've actually loaded to GitHub already that are being leveraged by the community. But also, it's nice to have access to the GitHub repository to then reach out and bring those capabilities onto the high side.
And you've got pretty big data sets. I mean, geospatial data is big. Are you sensing that the latencies and the response times are coming down? I mean, is that a problem anymore?
Oh, no. It is unbelievable how quickly this information is moving, but also how large it is. And I'm very impressed by our capabilities to kind of crunch it down, send it through, and make it available to a large number of people.
Now, we had one of your counterparts who was also one of the Tech Award leadership winners for the Women in Technology, Megan Coakley-McCarthy of the NIH. And she's looking at the microscopic world.
Yes.
But rendering it in a three-dimensional way. I wonder if there's convergence between the ability to look over a terrain in the subatomic world, or the atomic world, I guess, or the molecular world, as much as there is in the macro world of the Earth.
There is. And I listened to that interview, and she is fascinating. She sounded great. And we do. I was thinking about all the parallels that we actually have with 3D analytics. And so we have LiDAR capability, and it's the way to actually get 3D rendering of objects, buildings, equipment. And we also have those databases of information to help us with modeling for entity identification on imagery. So it's really exciting to see how she's doing it at the micro level and how we do it at the macro level.
Sierra Selman is a data scientist at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to all of our interviews at iTunes or Podcast One.
For decades, Leidos has been trusted by government and business to solve complex challenges with the application of IT, engineering, and science. This year, gain transformative insights from thought leaders at Leidos, ranked number one in government IT and systems integration, on top-of-mind topics including cloud, legacy systems, IT modernization, open systems, and cybersecurity. Hear more at federalnewsradio.com by searching Leidos. That's L-E-I-D-O-S.
U.S. Northern Command includes a relatively small unit dedicated to helping civilian authorities that respond to chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear incidents. Now the Joint Task Force Civil Support is adding digital mapping and other information-related capabilities. Joining me in studio with more, Richie Richardson, Geographic Information Systems Coordinator at Joint Task Force Civil Support. Mr. Richardson, good to have you on.
Hi, Tom. Nice to meet you.
Tell us a little bit about the Joint Task Force Civil Support. What does it do in the big picture?
Following a catastrophic incident, we deploy to the area, and we have mission command over about 5,000 troops that are there to support civil authorities, and whether it be in search and rescue or mass decontamination, or in a handful of other functional areas.
Okay, so there's about 200 of you normally, and then when something happens, you've got a lot at your command to help these local authorities, or I guess that can be state, local, whatever.
Yes, sir. So we have about 200 that work with us on a day-to-day basis, but our headquarters also grows by about another 400 as well. That enables us to be able to perform 24/7 operations and make sure that we don't have any gaps and seams and can support the forces in the field as well as we can.
All right, let's talk about GIS support, because I would think that local authorities that you would be responding to help would have maps of the areas that they're responding in.
So it's not only about the maps, it's also about being able to integrate everyone's maps, what everybody's doing, building a common operational picture. Most agencies have invested pretty heavily in developing a common operational picture. But over the past, what we've done is we've tried to synchronize and synthesize those pictures, and we've run into technical problems. So what we're doing now is we're all building against a common platform so that we're able to integrate each person's or each agency's information so we can build shared situational understanding.
In other words, a lot of people might have built mapping systems or their geographic information systems with non-compatible software originally?
Yes. That's exactly what's happened in the past, and we're working with our interagency partners, state and local, to make sure that if something were to happen, if there was a catastrophic event that we deployed to, we're able to plug directly in without interrupting their system, and also provide them with the information that we have in a format that they can ingest and use and provide their commanders and users with situational awareness.
All right, give me an example. Suppose something happens and local firefighters and maybe biological teams have to deploy to help, and they call on Northern Command, and what happens?
So within 2 hours, our first early entry command post would report to Joint Task Force Civil Support Headquarters, and then within another 2 hours, they'd be at the airport ready to deploy or beginning to move by ground, depending on the distance that we'd have to travel. Roughly within 24 hours, our first units begin to show up in the area and are able to respond and start performing missions shortly thereafter. from a GIS perspective, the first thing that we end up doing is we call into FEMA or DHS, whoever's hosting coordination calls, and we participate in that activity as well. So in addition to the members that we have going out the door 4 hours after an incident, starting at 2 hours, we have somebody come in who coordinates with the federal interagency groups, who then supplies our planning cells with as much information about what's going on. So once our units get in the field, they know who's to the right, who's to the left of them, so they're not introducing themselves, meeting people at the scene of the incident. They have some situational awareness in what they're going into, and they start pulling this information from us immediately. As soon as they respond in, they can pull this information via cell phone, tablet, laptop, any type of device that they have.
Richie Richardson is GIS coordinator at Joint Task Force Civil Support. I'm Tom Temin.
For decades, Leidos has been trusted by government and business to solve complex challenges with the application of IT, engineering, and science. This year, gain transformative insights from thought leaders at Leidos, ranked number one in government IT and systems integration, on top-of-mind topics including cloud, legacy systems, IT modernization, open systems, and cybersecurity. Hear more at federalnewsradio.com by searching Leidos. That's L-E-I-D-O-S.
We're speaking with Richie Richardson. He's GIS coordinator at Joint Task Force Civil Support. And so when you arrive, what is it that you bring? I mean, in terms of this mapping capability, do you bring, obviously not paper maps anymore, but you bring software, or how does it work?
We bring tablets. We bring laptops. We try to stay as light as possible. In order to move quickly, you have to lighten the load. Anything that we take with us is displacing a capability that may be used to help others who are actually who are in harm, who may need assistance, whether it's medical, search and rescue, or any of the other capabilities. So we have to be very cognizant of making sure our plan is as light as possible.
Sure. So you're backing up the first responders who are actually out there doing the tasks on the scene.
Yes, sir.
And tell me more about this idea of integrating different mapping systems so that people that are on the scene can have this comprehensive picture. What are some gaps that might be in a local mapping system? And then how do you help take disparate mapping systems and turn them into something that gives the whole picture in integrating all these different systems?
So the major gaps occur in terms of scope. What happens is that your local governments tend to focus on their locality. They may have other mapping information about what surrounds them, but it's still limited. And the scope of a catastrophic event or a complex catastrophe could and may exceed the geographic boundaries. I like to say that hazards don't recognize political borders. So whether it happens in one city or the next, the hazard doesn't stop because of the border. So when
their maps may stop.
Absolutely. So what happens is we have we use a federal data set that's compiled by DHS called HSIP, or Homeland Security Infrastructure Program. We use that program. Now it's called HIField, Homeland Infrastructure Foundation Level Data. And what we do is we take that data that's consistent across the entire United States, and we use it not just to show where things are, but to use it to help us shape and guide our force. Whether it's identifying how many trauma centers there are, what types of trauma centers, what their capabilities are. But we take that information and it helps us tailor our force. So in our joint planning group, or in our what we will do is we will provide our planners with the existing capability in the area, and then also what the delta is, what they may have lost. That helps us determine which units will deploy first and what we need to get into the area as quickly as possible. Since our 5,200 man force is coming from approximately 30 states from 88 different installations, so it is critical to understand who can get there when and who needs to get there the fastest. So that's one of the areas that we utilize these tools in.
And if you would briefly explain what form this all takes. Do you bring a software on a disk to these places, or this is something a little bit more up to date?
So the form is actually just an app that can be deployed to a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop, anything with a web browser. What we do is we make it as easy as possible, something that people are used to, like Zillow or Google Maps. We make it look and feel the same way with the same controls. We bring information to the user. So the person who's on the rubble pile actually performing search and rescue or extraction missions has that information at hand as quickly as possible.
And say it's a fire situation, for example, and another plume of fire breaks out somewhere over beyond the ridge. Can that information then be somehow brought into this so that everyone sees that new fire?
So they could type in hazmat and pull up if it's a chemical facility, if it was a if it represented a secondary hazard, or if it was just something to report, they could just click and drag a fire icon right onto it, hit save, and it would go to everybody who's using the app.
So if I'm using the app on Beyond the Ridge and I see something that everyone needs to know about, I can annotate on the app, and then all of a sudden everyone sees, hey, there's something beyond the ridge we need to know about.
Yes, from the private all the way up to the four-star commander.
So just to make a real simple example, suppose I'm a local responder. I may have something on my map, and what I don't know is beyond the county line, there's a chemical storage tank that might be endangered by a fire, for example. So with what you bring in, suddenly as the local responder, I could say, hey, you know what? 50 yards beyond where my map shows, there's a chemical plant or chemical storage.
Absolutely. You just described one of the components that we developed last week for hazmat materials. It allows us to zoom into any area in the U.S., and it gives us very succinctly what hazmat facilities are there, as well as what chemicals are there, and a rough order approximate of how much there is. It also then identifies the worst-case toxic and worst-case flammable.
All right, and you mentioned that the source of Joint Task Force Civil Support's mapping is Homeland Security. Is there any military mapping component that also comes into this?
So one of the combat agencies in National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, they support this effort as well. So we do they are primary members of the high field group that I mentioned earlier. And what they do is they serve as our primary voice in that effort, knowing that we need this information. Joint Task Force Civil Support doesn't need to essentially send a guy like me to represent the need for this data. We have four people on our team, and our time is, well, I'll just put it this way. Anytime that somebody asks us to do something, we have to weigh whether or not the priority can get accomplished, simply because we have so much to do in our four-man team.
All right, now you have these new tools that can help people get a more comprehensive picture of different mapping programs. How are you getting the word out to local authorities that this is available to them?
So we participate in every conference and working group that we can. Even if we are not the primary voice for DOD at those working groups, what we've done is our team has a lot of experience in this area. Between three of our four members, we actually have over 40 years of experience with Joint Task Force Civil Support. So in doing GIS. So when we go to a function, we've met the people there. We've followed them from agency to agency. We've seen a lot of them grow and develop. So we've built these relationships by, pardon the expression, but we go out and we have a beer with them. When we have a question about how did you do that, we'll grab somebody and say, let's go to dinner. And we will sit there and pick their brains. Then what we'll do is we'll figure out what those best common practices are. So when it comes to the state and local governments, we participate in as many organizations as we can in order to make sure that we're out there. At any given time, two or three of us are on the road preaching our wares. This is how we do things. How do you do things? And then we come back and we try to integrate those best common practices.
Richie Richardson is GIS coordinator at Joint Task Force Civil Support. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Find more information and a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to all of our interviews at iTunes or Podcast One. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to this week's Cloud Insight Show, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Cloud.